Professor Hare, thank you for being on the program.
Great pleasure.
How much is religious violence still a problem in Southeast Asia? Because we read reports from the Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, from the US State Department, and from NGOs suggesting there is continued tension, if not outright violence, through the Indonesian archipelago, Malaysia, Thailand, much of the region.
We have to see this in context. The Indonesian archipelago, Thailand, the Philippines are vast areas with very large populations. Therefore, the amount of religious violence is relatively small compared with the very successful efforts at mutual harmony. Nevertheless, we have to face the fact of what I would call the democratization of terror. That is, that it's possible for small groups of people throughout this area to create chaos if they so wish. And there are pockets of serious violence that have occurred. Of course, there is the continuing problems in Mindanao, in the southern part of the Philippines. Of course, we have had a resurgence of violence in the city of Ambon and in Poso, and there has been problems in West Java. These pockets are intense, but in this whole vast area with this large population, they have to be seen in relative terms, and there is clearly great success in creating stable and harmonious societies.
James, I take what you say about there being pockets of violence, but they're quite dramatic pockets of violence. If you look at the obvious examples, the Bali bombing, actions perpetrated by Jamaah Islamiya, by Abu Sayyaf, by Lashkar-e-Taiba, these incidents of violence really have convulsed the area in the last decade.
That is certainly so. That is certainly so. They have been dramatic, they have been apocalyptic. Nevertheless, it has to be said in context, and I'm not in any way trying to minimize these, but the potential with the democratization of terror, the potential for what could have happened, could have been much faster. That is to say, they could have been much more widespread in terms of land area and in terms of numbers of people involved, and they could have been continuous. And that certainly has not been the case. And that's the context against which I wish to present this.
So you're saying that governments in the region have been able to contain these outbreaks of violence as serious as they are?
Absolutely. They are serious. There's no question about that. They get a great deal of reporting, as indeed they should. But nevertheless, the potential for what could have happened in recent times against the atmosphere in which we live could have been much greater, and it's really against that possibility that we are talking as much as anything else.
If indeed the violence has been contained, do you still sense, though, and you have worked extensively in this area basically as a peacemaker, do you sense, though, that there is still religious tension?
I think there certainly is. I have to say I am impressed remarkably at how peaceable the situation which has become in recent years compared to what I knew in the past. 5 weeks ago, I traveled through the Malacca Islands, where I had done work in bringing conflict to an end in the past, and was overwhelmed by the degree of peaceful coexistence that there was. Nevertheless, it would have to be said, if one was to be sober about this, that the underlying possibilities of tension are there and must constantly be faced.
And if you don't mind my saying, James, as a one-time Presbyterian minister, you are nothing if but sober in your views and your appreciation of this.
Oh, well, I was brought up as a good Presbyterian with very strong views about human depravity, therefore never surprised.
At street level, how does some of this tension continue to manifest itself?
What it begins with is in the educational system, particularly with young people, with a high degree of stereotyping and, of course, a good addition of conspiracy theory. And that is the presentation of one's own faith as pure only if it is seen as opposed to something entirely different. And therefore there can be forms of strongly Protestant Christianity which can run into conflict with conservative Islam. Equally, there can be forms of very conservative Catholic faith which can run into problems both with Islam and with very strict forms of Buddhism. And it's these kinds of things that need to be addressed. And that's why the program that the Australian government has been engaged in putting so much money into the modernization of the madrasas throughout Indonesia, and the very strong support that that program has had and other work by the Indonesian government, has been very helpful.
Yes, your colleague at this conference, the delegation leader Tim Fischer, the former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, has indicated that the issue of, and let's be blunt about it, Saudi Arabian funding of religious schools and religious institutions in Southeast Asia remains a very controversial, if not problematic, issue.
Very much so. This is something that is of great difficulty. The amount of money that is coming in to Southeast Asia with very heavy strings attached, and of course is associated with the fact that Indonesia is an oil-producing country like Saudi Arabia, and of course our co-religionists, does in many ways make life very difficult for the Indonesian government. And it's against that background that I believe the Indonesians have been extremely courageous in trying to make a reasoned and middle stance. And it's in Australia's absolute interest to support the independence of Indonesia in facing this very difficult circumstance.
Given this influx of money from the Gulf, do you believe that Indonesia can maintain its image, indeed perhaps the reality, as the model moderate Islamic state?
I certainly do. First, it has a very strong Javanese tradition associated with the coming of many faiths, which sees faith from a Buddhist and Hindu, and indeed pre those religions, as something that is primarily moderate. Secondly, Indonesians are very strongly nationalistic. This is keenly felt if there's any threat whatsoever to the sovereignty of their country. And it is this strong nationalism which means they will not be dictated to by any outside force. And thirdly, Indonesia has been a multi-religious society from the beginning and has economically benefited from having links through Christians, particularly through the Chinese, through Muslim organizations, and through others, into becoming the success story it is. Let's not forget, GDP at the moment in this country, in Indonesia, is running at 6 to 7%. And that's remarkable, considering the situation we find ourselves in internationally.
There are other issues that continue to bubble away in the background, and they're things like blasphemy laws and laws against apostasy, laws against conversion from one religion to another. Do you sense that this area is encountering some liberalisation?
There's no doubt that there is liberalisation going on. One simply needs to look at the debates that are now taking place in Malaysia. Nevertheless, we have to realise that in all these social movements towards liberalisation, there will always be a hard core of those in whose interest it is to promote exclusivism and intolerance.
The Malaysian government in particular has to wrestle with this issue because, as you well know, we've seen one or two very prominent cases of Christians of Muslims who've tried to convert to Christianity who face very strong state sanctions. Could it be that, you know, this is just a bridge too far for some of these Asian governments to abolish the laws on apostasy is something that might invite a popular backlash.
Certainly. The problem is this, especially in a time of economic uncertainty, and whatever one may say, Southeast Asia is heavily influenced by global trends. It is a very brave government, in the words of Yes Minister, who can stand up to the lowest common denominator of conservative, indeed fundamentalist, religious belief, and can say we've got to move on from there, especially in times of economic uncertainty. However, the coming together of the forces of modernism, of the development of democratic societies, and that's certainly happening in Indonesia, which have been so overwhelming, and the growth of middle classes, means that these can eventually be overcome, and the signs are there that governments are beginning to tackle them, although nervous about doing so in difficult economic times.
What can governments do in concrete terms to stamp out religious extremism? And when I say concrete terms, I mean in ways that will be accepted by the population as not being repressive.
I think there are four things that are important that governments try to do in this area. First, it needs to be able to tell the success stories through the media of what peace building and community harmony has actually achieved. Now, we can see this in a small country like Singapore, which is relatively easy to deal with. It's more difficult in larger countries. Secondly, what they need to do is to institutionalize certain forms of education programs which will be for the whole of the community and cannot be hijacked by extremist groups within particular religions. And that's why the Australian Government Overseas Aid Program is so important. Thirdly, it needs, of course, to be able to show the ways in which you can be absolutely faithful to your own traditions, your own religious traditions, and nevertheless be part of a modern and successful society. That has happened in certain parts at certain times. It happened in the past well in Thailand, although it had a hiccup recently. And fourth, it has to make absolutely clear that the armed forces for the protecting of countries will not be caught up in internal religious violence and cease to be the armed forces, but simply become a kind of internal religiously inspired police force.
That means making sure that armies do not necessarily recruit from one particular religious group, and that has been a tendency in many countries throughout the world, hasn't it?
That has been a problem in the past, and that sadly is the inheritance of colonialism, because it was the Dutch and the British and the Portuguese who used this system. The Dutch used it particularly perniciously in Indonesia when it was the Dutch East Indies by having battalions from religious groupings. And they used in a particularly nefarious way in which, for example, if they wanted to put down a rebellion in a Christian area, they used forces from another Christian area, Christians killing Christians, or, as was more common, Muslims from one area killing Muslims. It is one of the worst parts of a colonial heritage. Because, of course, once militaries were set up in independent states, they largely used the processes of the previous colonial power. And that's something which is being worked through, but it's something which has to be got rid of.
James, one of the background issues has been the role of women. Is this an issue that can be reconciled?
I certainly think it is. In our discussions these days, and more generally, women are vital for the future of interfaith peace. They tend to be, of course, highly concerned with the situation of the family and with the community. They are, of course, also the worst victims, the most serious victims, they and children, as a result of violence. In many societies, they are marginalized and sidelined. In other societies, such as the emerging Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia, certainly, they are a very significant force in developing the country. And this has been highlighted in our discussions these days. It is very important that they give their contribution, not simply as people, as it were, who are liberated, but far more important that they are people who are responsible for good interreligious harmony.
And I guess the other key group here is young people, because they're often susceptible to the most extreme forms of religious propaganda.
That's right. There are those who are subject to propaganda and are therefore the foot soldiers of extremists, those who are prepared to carry out the extremes of others. And that is partially being addressed, for example, with the reform of the madrasas. There is, however, another group that's important, and that is the developing middle class, the technocrats, the technoheads. I was speaking to someone from Vietnam, which has become a problem in Vietnam. That is people who couldn't care less about anything, people who are disengaged, technocrats, highly developing wealthy lifestyles in the cities of Southeast Asia, but who have absented themselves from the issue. And they need to be re-engaged because they are pragmatic, but they are also people whose interests lie in working through interreligious harmony.
Yes, James, there was a time, though, when we thought that middle-class young people were immune from the blandishments of extremism, but yet since 9/11 and since we looked at the social profiles of many terrorists, many have indeed come from the middle class. What explains that?
Well, I think what happens is this, that these people are often immune from involvement in the social development of their countries. They extricate themselves. They then, ironically, become victims of very strong forms of extremist propaganda. Because they haven't thought through these things, ironically, they are very easy recruits to other people's manipulations. And, it must be said, they, not willing to argue, if you like, the humanitarian case for and against particular views, simply are taken up into this. And so you have the irony that the disadvantaged and marginalized rural youth often end up having a similar position to the technocrat who also is doing well out of the situation, but decides simply because of self-identity concerns to become involved in extremism. And that's something that certainly needs attention, and that's something that my friend from Vietnam was highlighting today.
Finally, James, and briefly, isn't the danger with these kind of conferences and summits that you're attending now that the participants, desperate to be respectful to each other and to each other's religious traditions, tend to tiptoe around issues and really tough issues are avoided?
That's, of course, a perfect possibility. That's the possibility of every summit, everything that the UN gets involved in, everything of a regional nature, that can be exactly the case. However, it is also true that people participating in these have particular hurts, particular experiences, particular issues that they solely want brought forth, and they are impelled to deal with them. Yesterday, for example, I was chairing a plenary in which a delegate, a Muslim from Burma, from Myanmar, was speaking about the situation of Muslims in Myanmar, which I had not myself thought greatly about. And so there is always the fact that the people of these things have to go back to their own communities. And that operates against tiptoeing around very painful issues. Now, they're not perfect. All summits are far from perfect. But nevertheless, one can but hope that something can eventually come out of discussions, either at a place like this or subsequently. And I don't know of any other way in which one can operate. But I think a certain degree of cynicism is no bad thing.
Professor James Hare, thank you very much for being part of the program.
pleasure. Very good to talk to you.